This is special coverage from WBUR in Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. It didn't take long. After the anger and the shock came the guilt and the self-doubt. The devastating attacks on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon must somehow be America's fault. After all, this country was built on the backs of slaves, oppressed peoples, and cheap oil, wasn't it? One African-American thinker and writer says, enough with this white guilt. The West must stop apologizing for its greatness, he says. The Third World must redeem itself by honest effort. Tonight, we talk with Shelby Steele about guilt, culture, and terrorism. First, Afghans in exile debated their future at a meeting today in Pakistan. Earlier, I spoke with BBC correspondent Susanna Price in Islamabad. She explained who's leading this effort.
Hundreds of Afghans came together in the Pakistani border town of Peshawar. Among them, there were some clerics, some former commanders. A lot of them were the supporters of the man who organized the meeting. He's a spiritual leader. He's also the head of what used to be a Mujahideen party, which was fighting against the Soviets. His name is Pir Gilani. He's obviously keen for some kind of role in a future government, but he's also supporting the former king of Afghanistan, Zahir Shah. And a lot of the speakers at this conference proclaim their support for the former king. Now, that's quite controversial because the king hasn't actually been back to Afghanistan for 30 years and didn't really distinguish himself during his reign. But a lot of people from the majority Pashtun ethnic group feel he could be one way to bring people together. The main drawback with this meeting was it wasn't broadly representative of the whole country. It didn't have members of the opposition Northern Alliance there, or those who were there weren't particularly significant figures. It didn't have moderate Taliban elements, and it didn't have vast representation from the various ethnic groups. I think the idea of the Americans getting involved, however, in any setting up of a broad-based administration would be strongly resisted. The Afghans are very independent people, and they will be wanting to form their own administration as much as they can without interference from outside.
Washington has publicly stated that it wants Afghans to shape their own future. Do you think this meeting, this kind of meeting, despite its lack of a broad-based view, will be welcomed by Washington or not because it's more narrowly focused?
It'll be welcome because it shows that people are beginning to think about what kind of administration will be put in place. It's the worry for Washington that while the fighting goes on, the twin-track political maneuvering doesn't seem to be getting anywhere. So at least this is a first step. At least it shows that somebody is thinking if that the Americans get ahead of themselves, the military campaign is a success, somehow the opposition Northern Alliance starts looking like it's going to take Kabul, there will be some kind of administration to put into place. So I would say the Americans will welcome this. However, I think they will be keen, once this kind of meeting has come up with some resolution, then to get the leaders from this meeting to come together with people from the opposition Northern Alliance and from other moderate Taliban elements and the other people. So this can be seen as a start, a positive start, but it's not going to provide the overall solution. And it's really going to be those meetings between the disparate elements that are going to be very tricky indeed.
And did this group meeting in Pakistan seem to indicate a readiness to meet with these other groups, an acknowledgement that the next government would need to be broad-based, including Northern Alliance, perhaps even some Taliban?
Well, absolutely. I spoke to Pir Gilani, the organizer himself, after the meeting. He said they were very open to other people coming. They wanted to meet members of the Northern Alliance. They had even met the president of the Northern Alliance and spoken to him on the telephone. They would also be willing to include moderate Taliban elements. In a way, they do have to say this, because if they say that they want to be the only ones running the country, they won't get any backing at all. What remains to be seen is what positive steps they take to do this. They say they did invite people and they didn't come. Now we'll really have to see some positive efforts being made by the people at this meeting to get the opposition and to get other elements together. And that's what everyone's really going to be watching.
Susanna, does the very fact of this meeting taking place indicate that these exiles feel that the Taliban may be heading toward its demise?
I think that's probably the signals that they're picking up from the international community. Basically, before the Taliban came under threat, people didn't really give them too much credence. Pir Gilani, the organizer of the meeting, was the head of a pretty small Mujahideen party. He was seen as a moderate. He was seen as a royalist. The idea of bringing back the king seemed more and more impossible. This whole operation has given him a new lease of life and has also given the idea of bringing back the king a new lease of life. So I think they will will be encouraged by the fact that the Taliban are under threat. There'll also be a lot of maneuvering now, and obviously if there is some kind of power vacuum, whoever is ready with some kind of administration will be best placed to get in there and start running the country.
Any chance that the king would actually be running the country, or would he be just a titular head?
Well, they're saying he would be the head of state. I think it's very early days at the moment to look at what kind of structure would be enforced in Afghanistan. And, of course, it's a long time since they've had any kind of government as we would know it, and certainly never really any kind of democratic government. So I think that will be discussed. But the king is 87. He hasn't been back in the country for 3 decades. Even when he was king, he was known more for hunting and fishing rather than ruling. The best people say about him is that there wasn't any fighting during his reign. So I don't think people will be looking to him for wise advice and leadership. I think he will be brought as a unity figure, someone everyone can agree on. And after him, then the jostling will begin for the real power positions. And I think Pir Gilani and the people who came to this meeting would have their eye on positions such as prime minister or the members of the cabinet. And they're the ones where the power will really reside. They'll be the ones, if you really look ahead, I suppose, who would be organizing any future elections.
President Bush talks about a post-Taliban nation-building role for the United Nations. Any comment on that, pro or con, today?
Yes, they were in favor of that, although they did say that they would like the United Nations to come in more in a peacekeeping role, they were talking about, and they were talking about Muslim nations. I think this idea of green helmets, of people coming in from Muslim nations, although they couldn't be too closely involved. So I don't think you would see people from neighboring nations such as Pakistan or Iran or even Turkey. But I think you'd need to find independent Muslim nations. They would be acceptable. And then, of course, afterwards, everyone is very much talking about how huge funds will be needed to be poured into the country for development. This will be the way to try and keep stability, to persuade people not to start fighting again. And the United Nations will have a major role to play in that reconstruction.
Susanna Price is the BBC correspondent in Islamabad. Thank you, Susanna.
Thank you.
Writer Shelby Steele says terrorism is a response to the anguish of inferiority. The terrorists may not have been able to build the World Trade Center, but they could strike it down. Is the power of Western civilization to blame, or is it just a scapegoat, profoundly the wrong target? Shelby Steele joins us from the studios of KAZU in Pacific Grove, California. He's a senior research fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University and has written extensively about race in American society. He's author of A Dream Deferred, The Second Betrayal of Black Freedom in America. Welcome, Shelby Steele.
Thank you for having me.
Good to have you with us. Also joining me in the studio is our guest news analyst, Robert Reich. He's the former U.S. Secretary of Labor and currently professor of economics and social policy at Brandeis University. Good evening, Robert Reich.
Well, good evening, Tom.
So, should Americans feel guilty for their nice homes and big cars? Did American decadence provoke the terrorist attacks? We're going to be talking about that this hour. You can join the conversation. Join us at 1-800-423-TALK. That's 1-800-423-8255. Shelby Steele, we can always count on you to make us perk up our ears. You've got a provocative thesis. You came out with it only 6 days after the September 11th attacks. What do you mean when you say that you see terrorism as the response to the anguish of inferiority?
Well, I think that, and I've sort of learned this by looking closely at Black American experience that Black Americans have had. One of the things that I think many people in America and the first world have overlooked is the trauma of coming from an oppressed situation into freedom, the shock of new freedom. Mm-hmm. How does one handle that? How does a group redefine itself and learn all of the many mechanisms and values and ideas that are necessary with which to handle new freedom? It has been a trauma around the world for formerly oppressed people to enter freedom. Africa is worse than the Mideast. The Mideast is in bad shape. Black America has not done nearly as well as it ought to have done. Freedom has almost correlated to decline in many of these areas. And so that is my point, is that it is the shock of freedom, the inability to know what to do with it, how to handle it, that then causes this inferiority that was once caused by racism and colonialism to be deepened.
So you're saying that even when the oppression is gone, the shock remains. Now, draw a line for us.
It's not the shock of oppression. The shock of oppression is overrated.
But the shock of
it's
freedom.
The shock of freedom is you are now free, but you don't know what to do with it. Your group does. Your culture does not have the ideas.
How does
the
that shock of freedom?
Values.
How does that shock of freedom, Shelby Steele, lead us to September 11th and
the
World
shock
Trade
of freedom
coming down?
Means that because you cannot handle it. You don't have the ideas and the principles and the cultural heritage to handle freedom. It means you fail. You go deeper into inferiority. You decline. You are aware of the fact that you are declining, and while the rest of the first world is sailing along, your former oppressor is growing by leaps and bounds, is moving ahead. There you are. And so you're living with that sense of inferiority. It's almost as though your liberation struggle was a fraud. It is almost as though your freedom confirms the racist notion of your inferiority. That, then, is the frustration that is unbearable and that comes out in the fascination throughout the Islamic world with religious consummation and, sadly, with terrorism as well.
So you see a direct line between that shock of freedom and the what you call the inability to deal with it.
Right. If you can't go up, if you can't move forward, you go back. You go backwards. And that's what we see in the Islamic world today, this regression to what? The 8th century, even, when Muhammad first came on the scene and this sort of idea of recreating that world.
Shelby Steele, at the other end of the scale, you say that the West should stop apologizing for the greatness of its civilization. What specifically are you pointing to there, and what do you
absolutely
mean?
Absolutely. Another part of this irony is the fact that the Western world did, in fact, colonialize these areas, Africa, the Mideast, so forth, did give in to racism, still has some of that. And so there is this profound sense of guilt throughout the Western, the first world, that where we now recognize what we did wrong, and we are vulnerable. And that's the point I want to make. White guilt is a vulnerability to the charge of racism or colonialism or bigotry.
But is it misplaced? Is there nothing to feel guilty for here?
It is misplaced. We fail to make a distinction. That it's one thing to correct for our history of racism and colonialism. But on the other hand, my guess is that had there been no racism, no colonialism, the Western world would still be great, would still be superior, because we have this long three millennia societal evolution going back to the Greeks, to Egypt, to rely on. It's given us these ideas. It's given us the scientific method, the idea that church and state have to be separated, the idea of individual rights. All these things were in place even before colonialism and racism were popular. So that is what the third world now needs. These are the ideas that are now the only ideas that can save the Islamic world. And if we are apologetic about them, and guilt-ridden, and as I talk about in the piece, if we this idea of moral equivalency, that we can't say that our values are good and that the reason we are this great culture is because of these ideas, then we have nothing to offer the third world. We have nothing to offer blacks in America. This is what we need.
Shelby Steele, we're going to take a break in just a minute. Before we do, Robert Reich, I want to turn to you. How does all this strike your ear? We've heard Shelby Steele make this case about black America. Now he's extending the case to the Islamic world. Does it ring true to you?
Well, Shelby Steele's case is provocative. It's interesting. I'm sure there's much to it, and it's very useful. But I wonder if it ignores or minimizes or leaves out, Tom, America's history of supporting corrupt dictatorships in the Middle East and elsewhere, the Shah of Iran, the Mujahideen. Our gruesome record advising them, training death squads, schooling and equipping torture specialists, helping them squirrel away their vast wealth. We've supplied Egypt with billions to build a state-of-the-art prison system in which thousands of political prisoners have done time over the last decade, including some who are now radicals. Now, this is not to in any way justify or excuse terrorism, but only to acknowledge our role in creating the conditions in which terrorism can flourish. Shelby Steele, am I just indulging in Western guilt?
Robert Reich, Shelby Steele, we're going to have to come back to that question. We're going to have to take a quick break here, but we're talking about Western civilization the anguish of inferiority in the third world, and whether that is the root of terrorism. Should we be all done with guilt? You can join us at 1-800-423-8255, 1-800-43-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight with Shelby Steele about his thesis that the West should stop apologizing for its success and that the third world, including the Islamic world, should pull itself up by its socks, get busy, see the values that can ultimately make it great, and stop wallowing in what he calls the anguish of inferiority. Get busy with the project of building itself up, perhaps in the model of the West. Do you buy this? Is this all about first world guilt and third world shame? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. We're talking with Shelby Steele, senior research fellow at the Hoover Institution at Stanford University. He's written widely and provocatively on race in America. Now he's looking abroad at the seedbed of terror with his own thesis on how it's evolved. Also with us this evening is Robert Reich, former U.S. Secretary of Labor, now at Brandeis University. Shelby Steele, just before the break, Robert Reich was saying, what about active American culpability here? What about U.S. support for authoritarian regimes over recent decades after colonialism? Is that not a just cause for anger in that part of the world?
Well, he's absolutely right. I mean, what I'm saying does not whitewash that in any way. I'm black. I was born into a segregated America, went to segregated schools. So I'm quite familiar with the hypocrisy and the capacity of America to do evil and stupid and clumsy things at home and abroad. Yet, think about this. Suppose I were born into a despised minority in Afghanistan.
Okay.
I can guarantee you that I would not have experienced what I did in America. I was born into that kind of a minority in America, and I was born into a society that had the ideas in place from 3,000 years of Western culture and evolution to understand that it was doing something wrong and to make and to try to correct that. Mm-hmm. And so I am here today because of those Western ideals. And my argument is that it is precisely those ideals, if they were to find and take root in a culture in a society like Afghanistan, that would free women, that would free that society from a lot of its ethnic conflict and so forth.
Shelby Steele, are you saying then, we want to understand, are you saying that Islam is somehow a failed branch of the human tree? Is it that's the religion of an inferior culture?
No. I'm saying that the single bad idea that I think is tormenting the Mideast is the idea that somehow through religion we can achieve the things that governments and secular ideals and principles achieve. One of the great things that happened in the Western, and we went through the same thing in the Christian Crusades and through the proselytizing of the Christian faith. But we then had a reformation where we sort of put religion in check, and we said that the state has to be run by principles that are, in a sense, beyond the reach of religion. Religion ought to be something that is a matter of private conscience. I think that is the secret to the success of Western society. Suppose we let religious groups have a valid claim on political power in American society. It would... There'd be blood in the streets, just as there is there. So I'm not criticizing Islam. I'm criticizing the illusion that prevails in these Islamic societies that religious fervor will answer the problems of inequality and poverty and so forth. It won't.
Shelby Steele, how on earth does this translate into foreign policy? We're looking now at a region that is on fire with religious fervor. And the great concern here, obvious in President Bush's remarks, is that we somehow insult that fervor in such a way that we make permanent or very long-term enemies there. Are you suggesting that we can somehow say, get over it, set Islam aside?
Well, that's a simplistic view. I think that, that number one, they don't like us anyway. and President Bush ought to be cognizant that they're not going to like us no matter what we do. But I think we started basics. As a society, we defend ourselves. We do not allow people to fly planes into buildings and kill 7,000 of our citizens. That's the first thing we do. The second thing we do is not be apologetic about the values that have made us great, and that we say to the Muslim world without, I don't mean in some sort of visiting colonial power, but we say to the Islamic world, look, your freedom is in separating religion from state, not in marrying the two. Your freedom is in giving, endowing individuals with rights and liberties. These values have made us great. That's why so. That's why the entire middle class of the Islamic world has run to America and the West.
Robert Reich?
I wonder if Shobi Steele, if you're not indulging in a little bit of a straw man here, because we are certainly defending ourselves. I think anybody looking at the last 6 weeks would be hard-pressed to say we're doing anything else.
Indeed.
And in terms of not being apologetic about our values, quite the contrary, we are standing up for our values. We are declaring to the world the superiority of our values. I think the real question I have for you is...
I don't see us doing that.
Well, I hear it all the time. I think that that's what the administration is doing every time it has any opportunity to talk about why we are there. George W. Bush, every time he has a chance to make any statement at all, talks about the values that we are defending and says that the reason that they are against us, the reason they are against us is because they are jealous of our freedoms, envious of our freedoms. That's what he said initially to America.
Well, have you heard any figure of importance in the American government say to the Islamic world, look, one of the deep problems you have is your attempt to marriage to marry your religion to an apparatus of state?
I'll tell you what I have heard, and in fact I've wondered about, and maybe you can help illuminate this one kind of perplexing corner. Do we, as the West, have any responsibility to help drain the swamp of misery, poverty, oppression in which terrorism grows?
That's a very good question. I go back to my own experience. I started out and worked in the 60s and worked in four different Great Society programs in terrible, impoverished areas, and where America finally recognized its responsibility to help the poor and so forth. I learned an awful lot in those situations. One thing I learned is that it's almost impossible to help someone who does not want to be helped. And one of the problems we have in the Islamic world is that there is not yet a recognition, there is not a full enough recognition of the source, the real source of their problems. As long as they continue to scapegoat the United States and Israel, they're my problem, they're why we are suffering, then I don't think much that we do is going to have an impact. Somehow or other, we've got to hold the line and again defend ourselves and articulate, do a much, much better job of articulating the values that have made us the first world.
Shobi Steele, you're always provocative. And again tonight, we've got a lot of people who want to join this conversation. We're at 1-800-423-8255. It's 1-800-423-TALK. We're talking with thinker and writer Shobi Steele about where guilt lies here. Is any trace of guilt about values being projected in the West misplaced here? And do we see the anguish of inferiority at work in the acts of terrorism on September 11th? Join the conversation. Jay is on the line. Welcome, Jay. You're on the air.
Hi. Greetings to all. Mr. Steele is actually misleading us by a very, very simplistic analysis of both the nature of Western civilization and Islamic society. For example, I mean, he is actually saying that democracy and liberty and the ideas of the separation of church and state are Western ideals. Now, I wonder how you can do that, because if you look at Western Europe even today, England doesn't have separation of church and state. Germany is a Christian country. The Holocaust happened in the heart of Europe 50 years ago. So what part of the Western heritage are you going to take and show to the world as ideas that you'd like to spread? And what part of a Western heritage are you going to reject and say, no, those are aberrations?
Shobi Steele?
Well, you know, I would just simply disagree. I think America is a good example of a society one point I think is important. For me, I always define democracy as a discipline of principles. None of these principles, separation of church and state, ever are perfectly implemented in our society. We struggle with them, though. We struggle with them because we know that they will make our society better and more stable and more productive and more free. And democracy is a project that never ends. It is a labor. It is a struggle. It has to be understood that way. I'm saying that we need to invite the Islamic world into that same struggle of principles, that same discipline of principles.
Shelby Steele, Jay is gone, but Jay, thank you for the call. Are you saying then, Shelby Steele, that in fact we can claim authorship of this entire laundry list singularly as the West?
I don't know. I'm the last person in the world to say that. What we call Western culture today, I much prefer V.S. Naipaul's term for it, which is the universal civilization, has been contributed to by sources from around the world, from the Islamic world, from Africa, from Asia. The idea is that the great thing about this universal civilization is that it takes whatever works from wherever it can. That is, it is an open culture, an open civilization. That is the secret to its greatness. It is the opposite of the Islamic culture, which is closed, exclusive, rejecting, repressive. In the West, there is this struggle constantly to be open, and that's what I think.
Let's bring in more callers. There are a lot that want to join us and speak with you, Shelby Steele. We're talking about what Shelby Steele has called white guilt and its misplaced position in consideration of terrorism and what's happened on September 11th and its aftermath, and also the anguish of inferiority that he says has produced this terrorism. Do you buy this analysis? We're at 1-800-423-8255. Maurice is on the line. Welcome, Maurice.
Hi, how are you?
We're well, thanks.
Thank you for taking my call. Actually, I guess my question to Shelby was, you mentioned that we're not really under the control of, I guess, a religious type of autocracy as some of the other countries are. And I guess, in our case, if you're Christian, you don't really notice that. If you're not Christian, I think you will suffer a little bit living in America or even North America, I guess, because that is the norm. I mean, all of our holidays are scheduled around that. All of our belief systems are either, I guess, built into the society as a whole. And, I mean, I think if you're a Muslim or if you're a Hindu or if you're a Buddhist in this society, I mean, the other day we had a concert in New York where, you know, a TV star, a movie star who is a practicing Buddhist got laughed and booed off the stage for advocating forgiveness.
So, Maurice, you're saying right. We're not all that free of religion in our own culture.
Well,
how about
no,
that?
No, no. Well, and one more thing, actually. I mean, I guess as far as guilt goes, I don't advocate that we should all feel guilty about what happened or that we should say that, you know, we feel guilty about the fact that the West has so much and other countries do not. But I think one thing that we are kind of lacking is any kind of empathy for anybody else's situation. I mean, I guess
we're the most empathetic civilization in the history of the world.
I would disagree.
As we bomb, we pass out food. If you want to see an unempathetic civilization, look at the Taliban.
But hang on, let's get the rest of Maurice's thought here. Maurice, do you buy that we're the most empathetic civilization?
No, I'm a Canadian. I live here in the States, and I come from another country just north of the border. And I'll tell you that as far as empathy goes, most of the people that I interact with on a daily basis, whether through work, whether through my interactions socially, could care less about the people dying in Afghanistan. One of the most horrible things I've heard people say is, well, you know, if we kill some innocent people over in Afghanistan, then that's just a few compared to the 7,000 that died in New York. I mean, to look at death in a way like that, to me, does not describe empathy.
We got it, Maurice. Thanks for your call. But yet, we have seen a great effort to avoid civilian casualties.
Can I answer that? Yes.
Yes,
we have
please.
We've seen a great effort to do that. He mentioned the Richard Gere incident the other day. He was booed. That's America. When you state your view, you might well be booed, but he was not put in jail.
Robert Reich?
I'm hard-pressed to understand why a conversation about which civilization or which culture is superior gets us very far. It seems to me that what we most need this day and age is for the Islamic culture and cultures and also the West to understand each other better. Shelby Steele, do we have anything to learn at all from Islam?
But listen, Robert, you don't really believe that we're sitting here arguing which one of the two is superior.
It sounds very much as if
Let me make this clear. There has been a human evolution of societies. You could trace it back to Egypt, through Greek thought, through Roman law, all the way up to the present day. That has been contributed to by every culture in the world. the problem that has happened in areas like Africa and the Mideast, where colonialism separated these people out of history, out of that evolutionary process. It separated Black Americans from that evolutionary process. That's the problem that these people, I am one of them, suffer from, is that we were not connected to history. We were disconnected from history. And that remains our problem. We cover it up by saying we're the victims of racism and colonialism and all this sort of thing. We're the victims of having been disconnected from history and now not being able to find a way back to a healthy connection to it.
Robert Reich, I know you want to respond to that, but let us get a caller in here as well. We're at 1-800-423-8255. Masood is on the line. Welcome, Masood.
Good evening, gentlemen.
Good evening.
I've been listening to your show and I'm enjoying it. And I must say, I don't exactly know the exact view of your guest, but so far the question you ask about, you know, I think yes, the answer is yes, that every society, every nation has the duty and responsibility to reach political and social matureness to establish a democratic ground to build on. And that is a given for any nation, and you cannot import it, export it, inject it, or any other way. You know, you just got to reach that point. And
but Masood, can the United States export that, impose that on the Middle East?
You can help. You can definitely help. And you know, I mean, I don't want to get derooted from your topics. If you want to get that way, in my opinion, United States foreign policy, because of the Cold War at the time, which had a lot to do with it, which brought U.S. interests first, and that made them to make many mistakes in Middle East. And I think that's what's hunting us back now. I think is our own doing, even though being 20, 30, 40, or 50 years ago, like I said.
Masood, the producers tell me you're from Iran. Do you hear something welcome in what Shelby Steele has to say, or is it offensive to you?
No, it's not defensive to me at all. Why should it be defensive? I mean, you know what? I think we should stop thinking about West, East, this and that. I mean, for God's sake.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, didn't you hear that we're sending
weaponry?
No, the device that we sent to one of the planets is orbiting the Mars, I believe.
Sure,
it is.
Voyager, yeah. With the human information.
Mm-hmm. Exactly, whatever it is. You know, I mean, so what I'm getting is we should stop thinking about, you know, east, west, north, south, and, you know, we're all from one planet. We should think more globally. We should, you know, we're all human. We're all from...
We've got it, Masood. We've got to take a break. Hang on if you'd like, but we're going to take a break here real quickly. We're talking about Shelby Steele's provocative thesis that the Islamic world, the third world, should look to Western values for guidance, should click in to what works in the body of human learning and get going with it. We're at 1-800-423-8255. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to special coverage from WBUR Boston. This is special coverage from WBUR Boston. I'm Tom Ashbrook. We're talking this hour with author Shelby Steele and with former U.S. Secretary of Labor Robert Reich. Shelby Steele's thesis is that the U.S. and the West should not apologize for its culture, but celebrate it, push it, bring it to the Islamic world, and that when we look at terror, we should understand that part of this is the anguish of inferiority, in his words. Robert Reich, we had to cut you off earlier. Masood came in, an Iranian, saying, seemed to say he welcomes this embrace of universal positive values that would lead countries in a more positive direction. Who could argue with that?
Who can argue with the notion that it's unhelpful for the poor of the Middle East to blame the Western civilization for their poverty, and certainly wrong to attack the West? I don't think there's any difficulty with that concept at all. But what troubles me, or at least perplexes me, Shelby Steele, is the implicit assumption in that the West has no responsibility at all here, that there are no acts of either commission or omission that might have somehow contributed to the anguish, the poverty, the oppression of people people in the Middle East that we have nothing to do but simply tell them how good we are and how great Western civilization is. Is that's not really the point you're making, is it?
Absolutely not. No, I would. We have made mistakes throughout the world, and as I say, I am aware of mistakes that we have made within our own society as a Black American. So I'm the last person to say that that we haven't done that. But that is isn't that in fact beside the point at this moment?
Well, that's the question: is it completely beside the point, or can we embrace both?
What I would agree
with
you.
It doesn't have to be one or the other, Shelby Steele.
No, it certainly does not. The way that we have grown in the West is by being frank and honest and open about the mistakes we have made. What civilized person in America today is going to say that slavery was a good thing? Or that segregation was a good thing.
But there has been
hard-pressed. The society has grappled with this by owning up to it.
But has
now,
there...
Now, you can't grow without owning up to it. What I'm saying is that the Islamic world also has an obligation. Here's what I'm saying.
No objection to that.
Here's what I'm saying. The fact that the Muslim world has an obligation to own up to its weaknesses does not correlate to saying that America has no responsibility whatsoever.
But have you heard?
We have a human responsibility.
But Shelby Steele, if I can just sneak in this one question to you. Have you heard very much discussion over the last 6 weeks or even over the last years of our culpability or at least contribution to the problem in terms of either propping up dictators or unswerving support for an Israeli government that's been assassinating Palestinian leaders and bombing Palestinian towns, or our turning our back on much of the poor of the entire world and not acting in a way that spreads the wealth?
Shelby Steele, we've just got a minute for your response there.
What? He brings in the Israeli...
the big guns in 1 minute.
In 1 minute.
That's all we've got.
I hear that all the time. We are a society filled with debate. We debate everything. We debate the Israeli-Palestinian situation relentlessly. We question our government. We question the people who run for office. That is, again, the greatness of our society. Nobody goes to jail. Everybody gets to have an argument and an opinion.
And Shelby Steele,
we do that.
Shelby Steele, 30 seconds. What's the practical advice that you would have us take away from this to inform our foreign policy right now?
I think our foreign policy right now, again, has to, number one, be defense against and response to the attack that we endured. Secondly, we have to be very clear. We have to do what we are loath to do, which is to make a judgment. We have to say the Muslim world is suffering because of, as I have said, this marriage of religion and state. That is one of the problems. We have to make those kinds of judgments and not push them down the throats of the Islamic world, but simply articulate them and stand by them.
Shelby Steele, you've never been afraid to make a judgment. Thanks for being with us this evening.
Thanks for having me.
You can read Shelby Steele's article on this subject by going to our website, log on to WBUR.org, and click on Special Coverage. You can also continue this conversation by going to Special Coverage Forums. Secretary of State Colin Powell made the rounds in Washington today. He spoke to reporters, lunched with British Foreign Secretary Jack Straw, and then testified before the House International Relations Committee. Powell reminded Congress members that the United States is not the aggressor in this war. Now, we'll take the time to hear some excerpts from his opening address.
Our purpose there is noble. It is an attack against who we are, our value systems, our belief in the dignity of the individual, our belief in democracy, our belief in the free enterprise system. That's what is an attack against. And it is not an attack that was delivered against us in the name of a faith. It is a violation of the faith of Islam. It is a violation of every known faith that any man or woman believes in. We must not let Osama bin Laden make this false claim. We cannot also let him make the claim that somehow he is doing it in the name of the Palestinian people or betrodden Muslims. He lifted not a finger. He gave not a dollar of the wealth that he had to help his fellow Muslims or to help the people who are suffering in the Middle East. Instead, he used his money for the worst sorts of purposes, to go out and murder innocent civilians. And we must not let him get away with delivering a message that is different from that simple message. As the president, there are some who have said, well, isn't the coalition a burden? Doesn't the coalition in some way constrain the president of the United States? The answer, it does not constrain him in the slightest. As we pull... Without this coalition, we wouldn't be able to wage this campaign. We wouldn't be able to conduct this war. If we're going after the financial systems of these organizations, you can't do it just by yourself. You need all the nations that have financial systems that are relevant to come into this coalition so we can work together. If you're going to go after the intelligence infrastructure that he uses so we can get inside of that intelligence system, then you have to use all the intelligence systems of the coalition members. If you want to deliver a military strike against Osama bin Laden and al-Qaeda and the Taliban regime, you need a coalition to do that. You need people. I will make one final point about this coalition. It was hard to stop it. Once people saw what happened on the 11th of September, they weren't just sitting around waiting for us to beg them to come into a coalition arrangement. Within 24 hours, NATO had acted, invoking Article 5. Within 48 hours, the UN had acted, passing a Security Council resolution and then a General Assembly resolution. And as we really got ourselves mobilized, they came in one after the other, the ANZUS Treaty invoked. And recently, the Organization of the Islamic Conference, 56 Islamic nations coming together. Just 2 weeks ago, we worried about it. Would they come out with something that might be troublesome for us? Instead, they came out with a strong, powerful statement that said what Osama bin Laden and his associates did on the 11th of September was wrong, was representative of no faith, was not representative of the faith of Islam, and was a desecration. And we have also had a number of nations that have come forward and said, look, we are with you in the whole strategy that you have laid out, not just to get al-Qaeda and Osama bin Laden in Afghanistan, but what happens after that, after the Taliban is defeated and they're no longer there. We want to be a part of that effort that puts in a new system, a new government for the Afghan people, a broad-based government representing all elements of Afghan society. We want to be a part of that. The UN wants to be a part of that. We know that may require some peacekeepers or others to go in to help this new government get up and running and started. And we're working with the UN and all interested nations in that regard. We're working with the different elements of Afghan society in the great diaspora that's around the world, working with the king in Rome, working with others, talking to all of the countries that are within the neighborhood to make sure that we have a sense of what everybody would like to do. Nations are also coming in and saying, once we get a new government in place that is representative of all the people of Afghanistan, we want to stay there in order to help build the country, perhaps for the first time, not just rebuild, but build for the first time to give hope to the people of Afghanistan. We are also working hard, Mr. Chairman, to deal with the public diplomacy aspects of this crisis. We want to get the message out that Osama bin Laden is evil, his action is evil. One of the problems we have is that out in the street, as they say, below the level of government, there are a number of citizens in Muslim countries who look at us as the aggressor. We're not the aggressor. We have never gone to attack any Islamic country. We have never gone to invade any Muslim people. We have never gone to subject them. We have gone to the Gulf to rescue Kuwait from Iraq. We are there as a force for stability, a force that protects the people of the region. And we have to do a better job of making our case, and we're hard at work doing that. The humanitarian challenge, as I touched on earlier, is a difficult one, and we're working with the United Nations, the World Food Program, and all of the neighboring countries to make sure we can do everything possible to get the tonnages in. And also, as this is a noble cause that we are all embarked upon, and it is a cause that we must prevail in. We must be persistent. We must be patient. This isn't a battle that's going to be won suddenly one day. It's going to be a campaign, a battle, a war that's going to continue. And people have asked me, how will we know when we have been successful? How will we know when we have won? And we will have won when we are living in security again, when we are being cautious about how we travel and the other things we do in our daily lives, but when we are once again secure in our homes, secure in our cities, secure in our official buildings here in Washington and elsewhere around the country, and when we get back to that America that we all know and love so well, we are not threatened by this kind of terrorism. And when we also help other nations around the world to get rid of the terrorist threats that they face. That's when we know we will have been successful. I believe we will be successful because the cause is just. It is the correct battle to fight at this time. And because I know that under President Bush's leadership, we will apply the resources, the will, and the determination to that challenge. And I'm quite confident we will enjoy the support of the American Congress, the American people, and the members of our coalition as we move forward.
Those were excerpts from remarks today by Secretary of State Colin Powell speaking before the U.S. House International Relations Committee. I'm joined again by Robert Reich, former Secretary of Labor in the Clinton administration. Robert Reich, Colin Powell closed there, in our excerpts at least, by saying, "We'll know we've won when we get back to that America we know and love so well." Can we get back to that?
Well, that's the big question. Do we ever see that old America again, Tom? Is that an America that was kind of a blessed America that was really an illusion in a sense, an America that was innocent? Have we lost our innocence permanently? Is terrorism a part of our lives like it has been a part of the lives of many people around the world? Can we ever, ever hope to go back to that halcyon existence again? I don't really know. I thought this was an interesting presentation today. He emphasized the coalition. Obviously, coalition partners are getting restive, some of them. Some of them are worrying about the effects of a concerted, continued, open-ended bombing raids on radical Islam, on the possibility of radicalizing more and more of heretofore moderate Islamic citizens around the world. I thought it was also interesting because of his emphasis on public diplomacy, public relations.
Getting obviously, the public message out to the street.
Obviously and clearly, the State Department is getting the message from a lot of our allies and from members of Congress. We're not doing a good job getting our story out.
Robert Reich, you've sat in the federal government and in the cabinet. What marks do you give the Bush administration at this point on their handling of the crisis?
Oh, I give them relatively high marks. But the question is what happens 6 weeks from now, 12 weeks from now? The real test, Tom, is when this drags out, is the public still going to be there? Are we going to avoid radicalizing the Islamic community around the world? And do we go into Iraq? Colin Powell said today, not in the excerpt we heard, but in a question-and-answer session after that, that the United States would consider actions directed at Iraq after completing its goals in Afghanistan. Now, that's a tremendously important step. We would consider that. I don't know what that means exactly, but they are laying the foundation, it seems to me, for moving into Iraq.
And clearly he's describing a sequential operation and, again, talking about this as a first step and then turning to mop up other scenes, other scenarios not yet quantified.
But will our coalition stand for moving into Iraq? Tony Blair himself, I think, probably the most active, outspoken member of our coalition. Tony Blair has expressed reservations about moving into Iraq. I think there would be a lot of pressure coming from his quarter and Europe in general, and not to extend the war.
Colin Powell was careful to say in what we excerpted here that nations were coming in for the whole strategy, in his words.
Well, that's an interesting question, and we need to know more. What does that mean?
Robert Reich, thanks very much for joining us tonight. Robert Reich is former U.S. Secretary of Labor, a guest news analyst for us this evening on Special Coverage. You can continue the conversation and see much more at WBUR.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. You're listening to Special Coverage from WBUR Boston.